Sidebar, episode 124, Tony Harris.
Welcome to Sidebar, four color conversations on comics, art, and pop culture, featuring creator interviews and roundtable discussions.
Today's episode was brought to you kicking and screaming by Graham Crackers Comics. You can blame them. Actually, no, you can shop with them online at grahamcrackers.com. They've got old comics, new comics, trades, graphic novels, a bunch of stuff. And if you find yourself in their home state of Illinois over the next 7 weeks, check it. They have an event going on. Between February 17th through March 31st, every Wednesday is Free Comic Book Day. That's correct. Every Wednesday between February 17th and March 31st, you can get three free comics from their 50-cent boxes. And me and my man Adrian love us some damn 50-cent boxes. We're cheap like that. Anyway, that's a pretty cool deal. Stop by any one of their nine locations and get your freebies. One visit per store, per person, per day, please. And remember, you can always give them your money via the interwebs at grahamcrackers.com. Cool? On today's show, it's the man of the hour, Tony Harris, pirate artist. You notice I started with pirate. Pirate artist, illustrator, one of the co-founders of Gaijin Studios, founder of Jolly Roger Studios, co-creator of the new Starman Jack Knight with popular writer James Robinson, co-creator of Ex Machina with popular writer Brian K. Vaughan, horror fan, family man, Macon, Georgia resident, and the focus of Desperado IDW Publishing's new art book, Tony Harris, Art and Skullduggery. We've known Tony more off than on, I guess, since he left Atlanta to go back to Macon. I know, go figure. He was the one Gaijin guy we knew the least until now. Dwight ran into him at Dragon Con last year. They chatted it up pretty good, and here we are. Tony was mad cool and gave us a lot of his time. He's celebrating his 20th year in comics and let us ask about everything. There's some background in there, some Starman, some Obergeist, some Ex-Mach, a little Jolly Roger talk, and definitely some art and skull duggery. We had a blast with dude, and he was no holds barred. He gave all and bared all, which is, you know, which we love. And really and truly, he's a passionate guy who loves his job and this medium. And I think all that kind of shines through. Before we get to Tony, though, we do want to point out the new button on our site's main page. Go to sidebarnation.com, look over in the margin, and you'll see a little donation button. Yes, we are now taking donations. Cash, Luchini, cheese, paper, bank, cheddar, ends, coinage. No, really, this podcast is free and will always be free, but we have a bit more overhead these days than we used to and could use a buck thrown our way. Our equipment from time to time needs upgrading. Stuff breaks, and there are lots of events that we like to be at podcasting, bringing you the audio funk, the eargasms that you love. And sometimes it's tougher than others to get there. Trust. Can anyone say San Diego? So here we are with our hands out saying, help little Dwight buy a new computer. Help little Swain get to C2E2 and the NYCC this year. With as little as $1, you can make a difference. And if it's $50, you can make a really big difference. So, anyways, whatever you got, we'll take it because we're broke as shit. All right, enough begging. On to the Ober artist himself, the comic industry's original pirate, Mr. Tony Harris. And we join the interview with Tony talking about who he is, what he is, and how he got into this nutty business. And listen at the end of the episode for a very cool Easter egg.
I'm an American comic book artist slash illustrator, born in 1969, makes me about 41 now. Mm-hmm. Got into the business right after high school. Never collected comics when I was a kid in earnest. Flirted with it a bit, like most kids do, but didn't really discover the medium until I was about 19. Fell in love with it immediately, immersed myself in it, and decided that's what I wanted to do for a living. And self-published originally in 89, a book called Blade. Mm-hmm. And then we got, after the first two issues, we got a cease and desist letter from Marvel. we were actually doing pretty goddamn good, too. I mean, you know, we did like 3,000 print run on the first issue.
Wow.
And then sold out completely and had to go back to press for another 2,000. So we did five G's on the first issue.
Jeez. That's pretty impressive. That was like, what, maybe 89 or 90?
Yeah, 89. And then we did the second issue and did like about 3,000 on that one and had a color cover, and it was a black and white book, obviously.
Okay.
And then after that, you know, just moved on to working for anybody who would hire me in the independent market, and worked on everything from Nightmare on Elm Street to Green Hornet, Planet of the Apes, Reanimator, I mean, Doc Savage, I mean, anybody who would hire me, basically.
Yeah, dude, you did a lot of stuff, man. And to your credit, it was called Blade with a B period, L period, A period, D period, E period. It wasn't just Blade.
You want me to drop some science on you?
Would you do that?
Yeah.
All right, here we go. Biological, logistic, attack, defense, entity.
That's what's up.
Wait, now. Are y'all laughing at me or with me?
With you, man.
I'm laughing at you. No, I'm just kidding. No, man, you and Seaborn, man, and y'all dug deep with your geek, yo. That was cool.
Yeah, man. I was fucking 19. What do you want?
Yeah, man. Hey, you were in it to win it, man. You had a good idea behind that, man. So I appreciate
it. Well, yeah. I mean, everybody's got to start somewhere. And yeah. You know, when I first started reading comics, a lot of the stuff I was reading at 19 was like Badger and Scout.
Yeah.
And Faust by Vigil and Quinn. And that was really the first stuff I was exposed to. So, you know, obviously I just kind of jumped with both feet into the whole hyper-violent black and white thing. And there was a huge boom with that stuff.
Right.
Right there at the end of the
80s. Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm,
yeah.
And so I went from that to doing indie stuff and a lot of cover stuff, and then got into doing some work for Epic and Marvel as an anchor and penciler, and then my first big work, really. Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what you call big, really. I mean, because I did some Nightbreed stuff at Epic and some Darkhold, you know, some Clive Barker stuff, and I was an anchor on the Hulk.
So dude, I'm gonna go back on you, Tony. I'm gonna go back to Spring Hill Jack, man.
Oh Jesus!
that was awesome, man. You rocked that, yeah.
Right there. That's a direct link to my original exposure in comics was Tim Vigil.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he had a huge impact on me when I first got in, and I didn't realize it until much later because I was naive and uneducated. As far as comics go, but you know, Tim's major influence, his main influence, is Wrightson.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I was not aware of Wrightson at that point. I was only aware of Tim, and so I met Tim at a convention in Greenville, South Carolina. In 89, and it was our first appearance, me and Seaborn, and we were promoting Blade, and I sat right next to Tim.
Wow.
And we got to know each other a little bit, and he was doing some Spring Hill Jack stuff. I can't remember the name of the publisher now, but it was Tim actually called and asked me to paint over his pencils, basically.
Okay.
And so that's how that job came about.
Hey, Tony, speaking of Tim and you talking about the influence of Bernie Wrights and whatnot, and we learned looking at the PDF of Art and Skullduggery, what Adam Hughes wrote as far as his portion or contribution to the book, that you're a huge horror fan.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, one would not think that looking at some of the stuff you've done, but if you look at some of the stuff you've done, you would think that.
Exactly.
It just depends.
Yeah.
Isn't that nuts?
Yeah.
I mean, you would not look at my body of work and go, oh, this is a horror guy.
Right.
Because most of my earlier work before comics was for White Wolf. Doing gaming stuff for like Werewolf and Vampire, and that really was where my love was and my roots were. And my first sort of indie work was Nightmare on Elm Street. And then on to like Reanimator and all that kind of stuff. But then when I got into the mainstream, I got away from that and got into just whatever, you know, whoever would pay me to do whatever. Mm-hmm. But what's crazy is I got into the business doing fully painted interiors. So my career track is kind of backwards. It really is. I got into the business at doing fully painted interiors on Elm Street, and then when I started doing stuff for Marvel and DC, it was like me inking people as an, you know, totally as an anchor, and
right.
then I started getting like little bitty jobs as, you know, short story stuff as a penciler, and then got penciling work on my own after that. So I kind of went backwards on the whole deal.
Right. Hey, Tony, now you live in Macon now, and you're not originally from Macon, but you've lived all of your life, for the most part, in Georgia, in Macon, Georgia, right?
Hell no.
Okay.
No, I'm a military brat. So
okay.
My dad was military like 26 years. So okay. I was born in Charleston, South Carolina, at the Navy Hospital.
Okay.
And moved my entire young life, literally about every 12 months to 24 months.
Oh.
So I never lived anywhere longer than about 2 years.
Okay.
Until I was in high school. And my father was stationed at Warner Robins Air Force Base, about 20 minutes south of Macon.
There we go.
Yeah, I know where that is.
Yep. And I started high school there, and my dad got new orders to ship out to either, I think it was either Japan or Germany. And he said, you know what, I've got my 20-plus years in. My oldest son just started high school, so I'm going to just go ahead and retire.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted me to finish school in one place, basically. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, yeah, I finished school in Warner Robins and then ended up in Macon after that.
Okay. And you lived in Athens for a while. You talked about that in the book. And then you also talked about, I guess, living in Atlanta for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of how you ended up, I guess, meeting the other members of Gaijin, and that studio formed. And then eventually you went back to Macon.
Yeah. When I graduated high school, all my friends and my girlfriend at the time were splitting the gutter. UGA in Athens.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have the money or the grades to go to college, and I had no direction at all, basically. So I said, well, fuck it, I'll just go to Athens. everybody else is going there, I'll go there too. So I went there and spent a year there, and that's where I really got into comics.
Okay.
Was in Athens, and then I was making trips up to Atlanta to conventions, and that's where I met like Stolfreeze and a lot of my guys who would be involved with Gaijin at that point.
Okay.
And then I after about a year in Athens, I called my dad and said, you know, I think I know what I want to do. Okay, what's that? I want to draw comic books. And
dad shakes his head, right? Walks away.
Yeah. What does that mean? Like, okay, you're aware that there are these things called comics.
Right.
Okay, well, I've discovered that there are these people that actually write them and draw them, and they're paid money to do that.
Okay.
and so I think I might could actually make a go of this thing. And can I move home?
Ah.
Because I have no money and I'm broke and whatever. So
yeah.
my dad said, yeah, come on home and I'll give you a year, you know, to get on your feet and try to make it. And I got my first job inside of 6 months.
Cool. Okay. That's all right, cool.
But then I had met Stolfreeze and some other guys in Atlanta, and I was making a lot of trips up on the weekend up to hang out with those guys in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And Brian was doing a bunch of work for Innovation at that time. And
I remember that.
Yep.
Yeah, and including Nightmare stuff. And I don't know if he was offered something he couldn't do or if he just threw my name in the ring or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I was offered that job and did a sample page and got hired.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Now, how long were you a member of Gaijin, man, before you ended up coming back to further south to Macon?
1 year.
Okay. Other than your self-publishing efforts, man, with Seaborn, which we were just talking about earlier, mm-hmm. with Blade and whatnot. Some of your first assignments were, I guess, like Nightmare and I guess Legion of Superheroes and Nightbreed, which was for Epic. But tell us how the whole Starman thing started with James Robinson and Archie Gordon, because you talk about it in the book, and it's a pretty cool story,
mm-hmm.
about how it starts and then it kind of stops and then it starts again, and then, you know, you finally end up getting the opportunity.
Yeah, well, I had, let me try to remember this correctly. That was back in the day where all of us up-and-comers were going to San Diego and a bunch of the big shows, mm-hmm. and it was like 10 of us piling in one hotel room, you know, and, you know, not showering for 3 days in a row. And,
oh, damn.
And guys sleeping in the fucking tub, and, you know, it was nuts. It was like me and, you know, Doug Gregory and Tim Bradstreet and just all the guys of my generation were all,
okay,
you know, just going to the show and like who's got a credit card who can get a room and then we'll all pitch in to pay for it. And
right. Yeah.
We went to San Diego 1 year and I met James Robinson there.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he had seen some stuff I'd done, you know, for the indie market.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember exactly what it was. And actually, you know what? That same year, this is weird. I actually met Alex Ross that year.
Okay, cool.
And that was, he was walking around with a portfolio of like marker comps and sketches for Marvels. And he was like this, you know, fat cowboy boot, Jordache jean wearing, beard having, mullet having, you know, young, hungry dude. And just a really awesome guy. And so James and I were hanging out and talking about stuff, and he was like, yeah, I'm gonna pitch this book to DC called Starman, and I think you'd be good for it. And we talked a little bit, and I was like, yeah, that sounds cool. You know, because like I said at the time, I was real young, and anything anybody wanted to pitch my way, I was willing to take a crack at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we talked about it, went our separate ways. I went back to Gaijin, did my thing. He went and did his thing. And I left Gaijin, came back to Macon, and sort of had a break with comics for a while. It was about 6 months.
Mm.
And I lost most of my contacts, actually. Had a bunch of personal problems.
Mm.
And I heard through the grapevine that James thought I was not interested in Starman.
Mm.
And so I'm going to call Cully Hamner,
okay,
who he had done Firearm with at Malibu.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately start calling everybody I knew, going, do you have James's number? Because I'd lost it, obviously. And I was like, oh, somebody please give me his number. So I finally got his number, and I called him up, and I was like, no, don't give that shit to Cully. No. He had his deal with Firearm. This is mine.
Okay.
I want this. And so I got James on the phone and we talked and I was like, yep, I'm down. I'm totally down. And in the interim, I had gotten a job on Green Lantern Corps Quarterly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the issue, but it was with Ron Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, yeah, it was Kevin Dooley was my editor. But I think he actually answered to Archie Goodwin at that point. He had the whole group editor thing,
mm-hmm.
At that point where you had like the Batman office answered to this guy and the Superman office answered to that guy. And
right.
So everything was sort of divided. It's not like that now. But
mm-hmm.
but so I had this job that I got hired for with Ron. And it was just a short 8-page story for, you know, Green Lantern Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually my first painted cover for DC Comics.
Mm-hmm.
Because they gave me the cover job. And it was supposed to be a pen and ink thing. And I somehow talked Archie Goodwin into letting me paint it.
Okay.
And so I did that job. And my inker on Starman, Wade Von Garbager, which, interesting story there, his original name was Wade Grawbadger.
Mm.
And I'm telling on you, Wade, if you're listening to this, because I think it's awesome. He did some research on his family and found out that his original German name was Wade von Grawbadger.
Mm.
And so he went and had it legally changed back to
that's
and
cool.
The fucking Vaughn back in there.
Right? I like that.
Yeah, man. Got a Baroness type feel
to it.
It
does. It does.
Exactly. So, yeah, Wade was actually kind of an intern and an assistant with us at Gaijin when I was working there, so that I got to know him there. And so when I got this Green Lantern job, I literally knew no inkers at all. And I said, well, shit, I know Wade. You know, he had helped Carl Story out a ton on some stuff. So I just literally just said, hey, do you want to come and do this with me? And so Wade inked me on that. And then Archie saw that job. And my whole position on Starman was literally contingent upon that gig.
Okay.
I mean, the whole thing teetered on that job.
Okay.
And I was kind of told that at the outset. Mm-hmm. We know you're talking to James about the Starman thing. So we're going to see how you do on this.
Mm-hmm.
And if we like what we see, then we'll give you a shot on Starman.
Okay.
And I got the job, so.
And the rest is history.
Yeah, yeah. Literally. You know? Literally. Yeah.
Hey, Tony, the relationship between Jack and David and their dad Ted was always the heart of that book, man. You mentioned a minute ago about your dad and coming from a military family and all that. Did you get to bring any of your personal perspective on like fathers and sons into the story with Jack, or was that mostly James's territory?
Oh no, I think the book was absolutely half James and half me.
Mm-hmm.
James has said more than once that. That I was sort of the visual heart of the book, and you know, Jack's words were from his heart, but my own personal relationship with my father had been strained for years, and I don't remember or I was never told about James and his dad, but I'm not sure about that, but I do know that mine was, you know, very strained at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And Archie, my editor, was literally a surrogate father to me. He was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
He's the reason I'm in comics now.
Mm-hmm.
He's the reason I did Starman. And he even said at the outset that, you know, I never expected you to do more than about four or five issues and then flake out.
Mm-hmm.
My rep at that time was pretty bad. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's an equal balance there between James and myself. My relationship with my father now is amazing, and I credit that, you know, in a large degree to Starman. It allowed me to sort of exercise some demons, and man, I can tell you, you know, tons of letters we got from guys and girls. Some of them were actually printed in our letter column too, thanking us for writing Starman and drawing Starman. Going, you know, oh, my relationship with my dad was so fucked up, and it was so weird, and by reading this comic, it showed me a way to kind of, you know, get around the bullshit and figure out a way to talk to my dad again, and to get those kind of letters from drawing a comic. And I love the medium, and I think our medium is just so underrated, and as an art form. And to get those kind of letters, man, made my day every time we got them, every damn time. It just, Starman came along at a time and just resonated with people in a way that it was just the right time. It was the right project at the right time. And I don't even know if Starman would work if it came out and premiered now in the same way we did it then. I don't even know if it would work now.
No, I mean, and that was kind of my thing, is the whole idea of the relationships with the dads. And I don't know, maybe there was a mood at the time. That was like the early to mid 90s, so there was a lot of angst in popular culture then.
Yeah, it was a young man angst thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just thought, you know, it was cool because it was, you know, you couldn't really say that there was like sibling rivalry necessarily, I guess, between David and
Oh no,
Jack's character.
Kid yourself. Those two fuckers hated each other.
Okay.
Cuz David was daddy's boy.
Right.
You know, he wanted to be just like Ted.
Right.
And Jack didn't want shit to do with it.
Yeah.
So there was plenty of rivalry there.
Okay. All right.
Go ahead. Yeah,
so, I mean, you actually won an Eisner for the Sand and Stars story arc. So how do you feel now to kind of reference pop culture again, to see things like homages being paid and like TV shows like Smallville's, not saying it's Starman, but saying it's a Star-Spangled Kid, but obviously that's Starman's staff.
Oh, I haven't seen that. She's got his staff?
Well, no, the guy who's a Star-Spangled Kid, who's another character entirely, not Jack Knight, actually has Starman's staff.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, dude.
It's the one I designed.
It looks like it.
Oh, shit. I haven't watched it. I didn't know that.
Well, the pisser about it is that this guy gets killed in the first show.
Oh, God damn it. Well, there goes that. Thank you very much, Wayne.
But it wasn't Jack Knight, though.
Yeah.
So it was
Sylvester Pemberton. Pemberton.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So. I don't know. I mean, that's cool. But when she came around and they gave her the staff, that was cool. And then Alex Ross actually did that interior gig recently where they had the museum.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You remember that? What was that? What book was that?
It was JSA, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And there was like a big museum shot where they were walking through and Jack was actually a wax figure.
Okay.
I have no idea what it was. I get my comps from DC every month, so I look through them, and I remember seeing that going, oh, that was cool.
Right.
It was actually Jack holding the staff in the JSA Museum, mm-hmm. which was kind of cool.
Was that the Justice book he did?
Where he was doing? Yeah, you know what? I think it was.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
Yeah, he was doing the paint, the finishes and the painted over somebody else's pencils. I know. Yeah, I used to collect. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's his Justice.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what it was.
Okay.
That's what it was.
I don't recall him being. I thought he was like a just a regular statue. Like a,
yeah, the, I think the penciler was Dougie Braithwaite.
There you go. There okay. you go. Yeah.
yeah.
There you go. So how did in terms now that was your first Eisner working on Starman, right? The work you did with Archie and James.
Yeah.
Okay. Now how was that, man? Was that a big deal to you? Were you more stoked about you talking about the book actually getting a large following and people writing you all these personal letters? Was that equally as satisfying for you to win an Eisner?
Oh, very much. Yeah, I mean, I was a young kid, and that was my first monthly, and literally, like I said before, the book that put me on the map, and to be in that room at San Diego with everybody, mm-hmm. you know, from the industry is in there, sitting there, you're looking around, and they're all there, mm-hmm. you know, and then to hear your name called out, and I think we had. It was like 2 or 3 years in a row where we had multiple nominations. It was like, you know, 4 or 5 every year for like the first couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually sitting at a table with Alex Ross that year that we won. And he and I were both nominated for Best Cover Artist.
Mm.
And he won. And he actually went up and said... And any of you who were there that night, you remember this. He said, you know what? This actually belongs to Tony.
Wow.
And guys like him that are doing painted covers every month.
Mm.
And I'm doing a miniseries and doing this and that. But these are the workhorses and the guys that are really putting it out. So that was really nice of him to say that.
Yeah.
But we had like 4 or 5... you know, nominations that year, and we won for Sand and Stars, which I'm so proud of.
Right.
That's, you know, I think some of the peak stuff we did on the book. Aside from issue 37, which I think is our best.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you did some covers afterwards?
Yeah, I was the cover artist for a while after
right.
that,
right.
actually.
Right.
And
right.
then my studio partner at the time, Andrew Robinson, I suggested him to Pete Tomasi as my replacement when I decided to leave. So.
And Andrew rocked it, sir.
Yes, he did.
Oh, man, did he not?
Oh,
did
man.
He not?
Andrew rocked it, sir. I was like, you know.
How do you think I feel? We were sharing studio space at the time, so
yeah.
I gave the job up. And then I got to look at his ass over there every day painting those damn covers.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what did I do?
Yeah, man. Yeah, man. Yeah, man. Andrew rocked it. I know you and he are buddies, but shit, he rocked that.
Yeah, he did, man.
Oh, yeah. He killed it, man. He killed it. Yeah.
He did his thing.
So, moving on down the line to Obergeist. And first off, could you define what an Obergeist is? Because it doesn't seem to exist in the English-German language translation dictionary.
Over spirit.
Over spirit. Okay. Oh, so Uber, basically. Geist.
Yeah, but you know, if you look into the languages, you know, it varies, but okay. It literally means over spirit.
Okay, cool. So the whole thing. Talk a little bit about how you know it was go. You were doing the series. You were rocking out the pages and everything. You're ready for it to go, and all of a sudden DC calls you a call, and you know it gets canceled. I know it's a setup, but go ahead.
Oh man, that was a hard fucking day. Mm-hmm. Archie had died, and Pete Tomasi came in as our editor on Starman, and I developed a lot of stuff with him. I did the JSA Liberty File stuff with him, and the sequel, The Unholy Three, and Lazarus Five. Mm-hmm. Colossal failure that it was.
But interesting.
Yeah. In its core concept, yes.
Right.
And of course, Obergeist. Yeah, we pitched the book to DC, and Dan Jolly and myself had been developing the book for, and I'm not kidding you, like 12 years. We had been developing Obergeist before Dan and I did The Mummy for Dark Horse.
Okay. Wow.
Which was literally at the beginning of my career. And DC actually bought Geist originally. And we got into it, and everything was going great. And I was actually drawing issue 4, the pencils for issue 4.
Mm.
It was a 6-issue mini. And issue 1, inked and colored, came across Paul Levitt's desk, and he lost his mind.
Wow.
He just went nuts and said, "Oh, Jesus Christ, we are not." Well, he didn't say that, of course. we are not going to publish this. Or more specifically, he said, "I'm not publishing this." Mm. And I think I just offended him with the book.
Mm.
And you know. And that's fine because, you know, he's the boss man.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, he was at that time. He ran the show, and he called the shots. And if he didn't feel like that was something he wanted to put the DC bullet on, yeah, I can't really fault him for that.
Right.
What I can fault DC for is not having a better chain of command. And when we pitched the book to DC, and it went through 4 group editors.
Right.
Hmm.
4. Not 1, not 2, not 3, but 4. And every one of those 4 guys had to read the product, sign off on the content, and send it upstairs.
Right.
And then to get 4 issues into it, and then to have the whole thing shit-canned, it stunk.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. But can you explain, you know, right now, to clear up any misconception about, you know, what the main character was doing, Jürgen Steinholz? Because to me, it seemed like it was about atonement and redemption to some degree, not about what it was from the prima facie, what you saw on the top.
Well, the main character, you know, without getting into, it's a complicated explanation, but
mm-hmm.
the main character, Jürgen Steinholz, was kind of a Josef Mengele.
Mm-hmm.
Of World War II. He was a Nazi butcher doctor who experimented on Jews in concentration camps and is exposed to Jewish prisoners who had extraordinary abilities.
Mm.
And it was part of the Nazi movement towards a super soldier program.
Mm-hmm.
And he has direct physical contact with one Jewish prisoner who has the ability, and he touches Jürgen and shows him in 2 seconds everything that the Nazis have done to the Jews and torturing people, and it just shows him all the horror mm-hmm. in like two seconds flat by physical contact. And Jürgen just decides, I can't be a part of this. It's awful. And he goes to Mengele and to the camp commandant and says, "Look, we can't do this." And so they go, "Okay, well, if you're not going to be a part of it, then you're going to be the next test subject."
Hmm.
And they stick him in a chair and they fuck him up and throw him into a mass grave. And then he's imbued with the power from that one Jewish man touching him. And it stays dormant for centuries.
Hmm.
And then awakes with that power, you know, full force. Mm. And is approached by two, quote, angels, because I don't want to give away too much for people who have not read it. And they give him the option. They give him, you know, they say, hey, if you could go back and if you could change things on even a small fundamental level and make the world a better place, would you be interested in doing that in exchange for redemption for what you were part of doing? Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, yeah, absolutely. And little does he know that they're demons. Mm-hmm. And they're terrified of the fact that if the world does end, Armageddon does happen, Satan and all of his minions and demons are all going to be thrown into the pit of hell and chains for all of eternity. So they are keeping their own interest in mind. They want to continue to torment mankind on planet Earth. So they screw with him and tell him that he can do something to change things and make the world better. But they don't send him back to the 40s where he was. Mm-hmm. They send him into the future from his time, into like 2015 or something like that, where the Nazi party has like resurfaced in America and seceded from the country, and there's like another civil war on the horizon for America. And he's thrown right into the middle of all that. So that's the easy the easy explanation. It's a complicated book.
Yeah, and it's an epic tale, man. And
it's very complicated. Yeah,
I totally dig it, man. If I know you probably don't want to talk about who the two angels are, quote unquote, but I found that to be extremely interesting myself. I kind of have to do a filibuster and give it away, Tony. So.
Montague and Capulet.
Right. That's awesome, man. I mean, whose idea was
Romeo
that?
Romeo and Juliet, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was totally, you know, Dan there, my writer on the book, and we just thought it was apropos. Mm. And the book for me personally was a huge journey, because I was raised a certain way, you know, as far as religion goes, and so this book personally for me was sort of a journey to kind of figure out, okay, what do I believe, what do I not believe, mm-hmm. you know, what's feasible and what's horseshit. Mm-hmm. And so you'll find Norse mythology, Judaism, Christianity, Catholicism. I mean, there's everything is in there. Mm-hmm. We sort of took little bits of every religion that we thought made sense and sort of folded it into the book. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even sure I found a solution at the end. but you know, it's a journey. You know, that's a hard struggle for people, I think, if they don't just have devout faith, mm-hmm. To try to figure out what is the right path for themselves. And for me, I still haven't figured it out. But mm-hmm. but Obergeist was, you know, a 15-year-long journey for myself, trying to figure out what I think is feasible, and I'm still not there. Mm. And our audience was totally polarized. I mean, we had half the guys reading the book going, oh, what a fucker. Mm-hmm. No, given what this guy's done, there's no way in hell he's ever, you know, going to be able to redeem himself on mm-hmm. any level.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then the other group of guys going, you know what? What a bastard. But damn, I hope he can do something. Mm-hmm. You know, on the smallest, you know, level to kind of maybe make up for the bullshit he was a part of. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, either way, you look at that either way, and it still resonated with people.
Mm-hmm. Not to mention, man, the kick-ass design that you for the character.
Yeah.
You know, I know that you have a serious background in the horror genre, and I was wondering, of course, were you probably influenced by maybe the parts of Invisible Man or other characters like that to create the look for?
I purposefully sort of divorced myself from all the photorealistic stuff. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I said, look, we're going to do this book. We're dealing with really hardcore subject matter. Mm-hmm. So I thought, and right or wrong, judge me as you will, but right or wrong, at the time I thought doing a more cartoony style would bring a little bit of levity to the subject matter. And so that's the reason I chose to do what I did artistically there. Because if you look at it, it's totally different than anything I've ever done.
It's quite a departure. But the covers still were stellar, and it was totally you.
It was the covers?
Totally, yes, man. The color.
Oh, well, I stuck with my shit on that.
Yeah. Yeah, you did. And yeah, man, it was they're incredible. And the interiors were great too, but I mean the covers, they sold it along with the incredible stories on the inside for me, man. I was like, okay, I got to have this on a month-to-month basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, the one cover I did that I just had so much fun with was Jim Royal, who was part of our studio at the time. He's passed away now, bless his heart.
Mm-hmm.
I used him as a model for Geist a whole lot back then. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember which issue it was, but there was a cover where it was Geist shirtless with the goggles on, and he had the word guilt.
Yes.
All over his body.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
I think that's the most powerful cover.
Yeah, man.
From the series. So.
It's damn profound, sir.
Oh, man. Hey, you talk about DC, and I know you've done some work for Marvel, like Spider-Man and Iron Man, and I think even like a Doctor Strange. But you spent most of your time at DC, and now, you know, DC Wildstorm with X-Mach. Why has DC kind of been like home for you, man?
I just think I just kind of clicked with their characters more.
Mm.
It just really, it's that simple.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really identify with Marvel characters as much as I do with DC.
Mm.
And I it's really down to personal taste. I mean, my favorite characters in the world as far as superheroes go are the original Golden Age guys. And that was the whole basis for us doing the Liberty File stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that was back during the day when they were still doing, Elseworlds stuff.
Yes, mm-hmm. Which I miss.
Yeah, great stuff.
Definitely. Moving on to Ex Machina, man. When X-Mach came along, was it the right time for you in your mind? And I asked that because, Tony, everything that I like about your work seems to be present in X-Mach. There's a superhero theme, kind of. There's characters who are acting and emoting. And there's, you know, kind of a freaky, you know, steampunkish kind of a, you know, almost a military kind of a design ethic for the Great Machine.
Which is ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Oh, I do love me some steampunk shit.
Yeah. But what do you think it came along at the right time where, you know, your skills and your design and everything could kind of be like put to the test? Because to me, it's like, you know, to quote Klaus Janson, you know, not to offend anybody who considers Starman to be, you know, your pinnacle. Mm-hmm. This is you at the height of your powers to me.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
But I still don't think I'm there yet.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, everything I've done, you know, I'm still looking for that high point. You know, I'm always looking to improve and get better, but I appreciate what you said. Machina came around exactly at the right time for me. I'd only done one monthly Starman before that, and then jumped around, did a bunch of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always interested in doing another monthly, but just never had been offered the right thing. I mean, I'd been talking to tons of people at DC and Marvel about doing another monthly. I was offered Batman at one point, and a Superman book, and you know, all kinds of different things. And nothing just kind of, you know, rang true with me. And I've always conducted my career on two levels where, and if you look back through the art book, you'll see that I'm telling you the truth here.
Mm-hmm.
I've always done just enough company owned mainstream stuff to keep my name out there and mm-hmm. be popular
mm-hmm.
so that I could transform that visibility into attention for any kind of creator-owned thing I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I liken that to a film where you have, you know, an actor who does a studio film.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's a big, like, mainstream, you know, tentpole thing for the summer or whatever. And then they go off and do, like, you know, five or six you know, independent films.
Right, right.
For no money, just because they love doing it. And that's how I've always operated, was, you know, I love comics. I love comics. I love superheroes on some level. you know, I do think that the medium has so much more to offer than guys in the underwear. I know that's what the business is built on, so you have to have a healthy respect for that. And that's why I try to come at it where I can give it its respect with things like Liberty File and Doctor Strange. And
right.
Like. But Machina came along totally at the right time, because I'd only done one monthly before this in 20 years, and they were looking for a, and I was told this by Wildstorm, they were looking for a, quote, Tony Harris type.
Okay.
and Brian had actually pitched the book a year before I was hired.
Okay.
And they could not find a fucking artist for it. And they talked to people and looked around. They just couldn't. And then finally, I was pitching a creator-owned thing to Scott Dunbeer, who was then the editor-in-chief there.
Right.
And put it up through the channels, and DC said, it's just not commercial enough for us. And and then Scott said, well, would you be willing to look at, you know, some other creator-owned stuff? And I was like, well, shit, yeah. You know, my plate's open right now, so I'll look at anything. And he sent me Desolation Jones.
Yeah.
And I passed on that.
You would have been nice on that too, Tony.
Yeah. I love me some J.H. Williams III. Don't,
yeah, man.
I can't.
Well, no, yeah. And I had already done, what's the other book I did with Warren?
The Batman book?
No, Down.
Down, okay.
You got I did down over there.
You got some explaining to do about that whole gun in a certain region of the young lady with on Down too.
Oh yeah, the profile shot.
That's my lady dick shot. and hey, let me tell you a little secret about that piece. Look at that cover in the art book, and the shadow casting on the wall. The shadow of the gun is going right up her ass.
Oh. Wow.
Anyway, I digress.
Yes, you do.
So they were like, yeah, let's get a Tony Harris type on this book. And I think Brian or somebody said, well, why don't we just fucking ask Tony?
Right.
Okay.
And then Scott was like, well, shit, he just pitched something to me. And I said, no. So let's show it to him. So they showed me Desolation and one other thing. I don't remember what it was. And I was like, it's not my thing. And I read Machina, and literally in like 10 minutes, I called him back. I was like, I have to do this. It was the most different thing I'd read in years.
Yeah.
I'd never read anything like it. And that's always the way I've operated, was like, I always want to do something that's a little bit off the beaten track, you know? And truth be told, I never thought we'd get past maybe, you know, 6 or 8 issues. Because it's all politics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, a little bit of action here and there. You know,
a little flashback here and there.
Yeah. And I never thought we'd get past about 6 or 8 issues, and here we are. I'm drawing issue 49. Row, motherfucker.
That's crazy, though, man. But I mean, I think it's a testament again to the strength of the story and the writing, and the, you know, the acting that you have the characters doing in the book, and you know, there's a. Immediately, you know, from the very first, I started to say trade, but the very first issue, what kind of a person, you know, Mitchell's mother is, what kind of a kid he is, and, you know, all the characters are very well defined without having to do a lot of expository dialogue. You know, and a lot of explaining. You know, you get who they are just by their demeanor, and part of that is a credit to your character designs too, because you know you can look and see. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, wow.
Yeah.
But as far as you jumping in on it, man, I mean, again, another huge undertaking, because I mean, you got all this reference for political stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's going back and forth in time.
Right.
You know, you've got the Brooklyn Bridge prominent, you know, as a character in the origin.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because the Brooklyn Bridge is definitely a big character in the book.
Yeah.
You know? And New York City too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And even like the whole, you know, the whole reference to 9/11 and mm-hmm. how that was handled, and I was like, you know, oh fuck.
Right.
This is, you know,
absolutely brought it.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, and even his power is not like a power.
Yeah.
But it is a power.
Right.
And like, I mean, even, you know, from the get go, Brian pitched the book, and he said this in a couple of interviews, mm-hmm. Where his original idea for Mitchell was a typical tight wearing, cape wearing dude. Superhero, guy okay. with a cape and tights. And I was hired, and I looked at Mitchell's powers, and I was like, okay, well, you know, he controls machines.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he should be grounded in a machine-ridden world mm-hmm. where everything around him is all machines, where he's, like, creating things and doing this, and, you know, everything about his costume is all shit he could get from, like, an army surplus store,
mm-hmm,
or he could go to a junkyard and like pull parts out of an old piece of shit car and like, you know. And then Brian came up with the idea of this power that was given to him causes him to have dreams, and in these dreams he dreams schematics for these machines,
mm-hmm.
and That's wakes hot. Up and doesn't even know how the hell he dreamed it, but then Kremlin comes in and builds it for him.
Right.
You know, I'm like, oh, well, and that's really a total melding and total collaboration. And I've said this many times in the press, and this is the only time in 20 years of me working that I've had a true 100% collaboration with a writer. Mm. Brian has always been so open to anything that I've got to say. Like, I just read the script for 49, like 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I called him up and I was like, oh, this was fucking awesome. And I was like, what about this? What about this? And he was like, well, hey, if you have concerns about that, we can like address that and like go back to that scene or whatever. And I'm like, no, I'm not saying change anything. I'm just saying, and then he was like, well, you know what? You haven't offended me, but I love the fact that you're so devoted and married to this shit
mm-hmm.
right down to the last issue that you're concerned about every single scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I am, because, I mean, from issue one, you know, the core of our book has always been interaction between individuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mitchell and Dave and Bradbury and you know.
The action has always taken a backseat to interpersonal conflict
mm-hmm.
and politics and the drama that comes from that, and that's why I from the get-go cast the book like we were doing a film and mm-hmm. said I've got to have a face for every one of these people.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really the first, I mean, I did it to some degree in Starman, but this is the first book I ever did where I said, all right, each one of these characters has to have a specific face because we're not doing a bunch of huge set piece action things. It's all, you know, New York City politics and, you know, the shit that comes from that. And we have to have, like, I think I said this in the art book, in the text where, you know, whether it's, you know, Steve Jenkins, you know, on the street buying a cup of coffee or fighting a four-legged monster on the top of a skyscraper, you can look at that guy and go, oh, look at Steve.
Right. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas when I first got into the business, one of the major problems I had with a lot of artists, and I'm not saying I'm better or worse than anybody else, is that, you know, oh, look, here's a white guy, here's a black guy. But the only they look exactly the same,
right?
And the only thing that makes them different is the colorist.
Right. Yeah.
And that time I think is gone. That's past. That's over. And I think fans, even though they might not have actually realized it at this point, I think fans want, you know, that they want that investment from the artist.
Okay. Okay.
You know, if you can look at the art on a book and see that the artist is invested in the project, you're going to be more passionate about reading it, and, mm-hmm. and especially if it's an ongoing series, you know, mm-hmm. you're going to be more invested in the book if you can look at the art and see that, oh, this guy's passionate. He's doing this, and he's going above and beyond. And I know I've had weak issues, and I've had, you know, scenes where I dropped the ball or I was having a shitty week or whatever. But I think, you know, cohesively over the 49 issues, mm-hmm. you can look at the book and there's a consistency there. Mm-hmm. And I was dedicated to that from day one, even to the point where, you know, I had Wildstorm come to me and say, oh, well, we might want to think about doing some fill-ins. Mm-hmm. And I fought tooth and nail and said, we're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. And they were like, well, how the hell are we not going to do that? You can't do 12 issues a year. And I said, well, no, I can do 10. And we've been doing the book 5 years. And if you look over our publishing schedule, we have published, on average, 10 issues a year. Mm-hmm. And what I said to them was, we can do specials. We can bring in someone else to draw an issue or two that has to do with the Great Machine, but not with the body of story for the main deal.
Right.
And it you don't have to have read the main series to get onto it. Mm-hmm. You miss nothing either way. But we cannot interrupt the numbering of the series. Mm-hmm. It's got to be 1 through 50. Mm-hmm. And I got a lot of shit initially from that. You know, DC didn't want to do it. And they were like, well, no, we have to do fill-ins and whatever. And I'm like, look, you can call me a selfish prick, whatever you want, but it's important to me that at the end of the day that issues 1 through 50 were drawn by me, mm-hmm. written by Brian. Mm-hmm. And to DC's credit, they got behind it.
Definitely.
And thank God, because when we're finished with the series and all the trades are out, and all the hardcovers come out, it's going to be Brian and me and J.D. Mettler.
That's it.
And Tom Feaster.
And Tom Feaster and Jim Clark. Mm-hmm. And it's a handful of guys that were there from the beginning. And that's why I said me, Brian, and J.D., because three of us have been there from the beginning.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But as a fan myself, that goes a long way with me on the series. Mm-hmm. Where I know what I'm getting every month, and I don't have to worry about what who's going to be the damn filling guy this month.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it's like a completed novel. It's a masterwork.
Yeah, and Brian was always that way from the get-go, where he was like, you know, I have a big picture here, and I want it to be a certain way, and that's why I got on board with that early on and said, we don't need to have fill-ins.
Yeah.
And we need to do whatever we can do to make sure that does not happen, mm-hmm. you know?
Definitely. Let's move ahead, man. Let's go ahead and talk about the art book, Art and Skullduggery, as it were, mm-hmm. and talk about
with one L,
yeah. I noticed that. I was like, wait a minute, what's going on?
Yeah, the word skullduggery literally means evil deeds for money.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
You will do bad shit if you get paid.
Okay.
And you have.
Yeah. I think the OJs wrote a song about that too. But that's cool, man. Then we want to talk about Jolly Roger as well, because I see them both as, you know, being, you know, interlocked, obviously.
Right.
Because you've had this pirate thing going on for years now, but
21 years, man.
Exactly.
Arr.
Yeah. Tell us, man, about Jolly Roger proper, if you will, and who some of the past and present members are, and why you have stayed with the, you know, the surly image of a pirate as your public avatar, so to speak.
Well, if you've ever laid eyes on me,
okay,
I'm a fucking pirate. I love pirates. Mm-hmm. Always have. My favorite American illustrator is Howard Pyle. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Made his career on that stuff. And when I got in the business, I was the understudy to Craig Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And he lived in an old Victorian house in Macon here. And his studio was up in the attic. Mm-hmm. And when you were in the attic, the windows were all around the bottom of the floor. And it was all like, you know, hardwood and beams everywhere. Mm. And it looked like you were in the belly of a pirate ship.
Mm.
And people were coming by all the time, you know, wanting to hang out and whatever. Mm-hmm. And one night we took a piece of paper and we drew a skull and crossbones on the paper and said, "Artists at work, enter at your own risk." Mm-hmm. We got sick and tired of the bullshit. So many people were coming by, we couldn't get any work done. And we stuck that on the front door of the outside of the house. And Craig, at the time, was drawing Peter Pan.
Mm. Okay.
And, of course, you know, Captain Hook's ship was called the Jolly Roger.
Right.
And so that's where the name of the studio came from.
Awesome.
Okay. Right, awesome. Right.
And that was when I was assisting, you know, Craig, of course. And then I left to go up to Gajan and do all that. But I've always operated under that name.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Arr. That's cool, man.
Okay.
But, yeah, we've had a pretty cool roster over the years. I mean, it was myself and Ray Snyder and Dan Jolly and Andrew Robinson, Jim Royal, mm-hmm. Drew Geraci.
Oh, Dinker.
Mm-hmm. Who else? Drew Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Dusty Abel.
Mm-hmm. Tom Feaster for a while.
Is
JD's a member of the studio, right?
JD Mettler? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, the studio is just me and JD now, so.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Art and Skullduggery, man, comes out in March, correct?
Yes.
Okay, yep. And it's published by Desperado IDW.
Yep.
And you and Joe Pruitt put the book together. Now, how did the ball start rolling as far as the book goes? And, you know, what's the road been like up from the start up until now?
Man, it was like a 3-year deal. Maybe longer, actually. Originally, 12 Gauge
mm-hmm.
Contacted me and said, "Hey, we want to do some art books." And Kevin Gardner called, and I think I was the first guy he called. And we got everything rolling there, and that went on for about probably a year. And we went through two designers and starts and stops and all kinds of stuff. And finally, I was at a convention recently, last year, and Joe and I go way back, Joe Pruitt.
Uh-huh.
Like, back to high school.
Okay.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, Warner Robins High School. He okay. graduated, like, two years before me, but yeah, we go way back. And, like Negative Burn back.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which was the hotness back in the day, sir.
Oh, I know, man. I did a bunch of stuff. And Obergeist actually appeared in Negative Burn. So we're at a convention and we're bullshitting, talking, and I'm like, "Yeah, I'm doing this. I'm trying to do this art book, and it's like start and stop and start and stop and start and stop." And he was like, "I'll do it."
Okay.
And you know, I'm standing at his booth, and he's got like the Brian Bolan book and the P. Craig Russell book and the Tim Bradstreet and the Joe Jusco book, and I'm like, "Well, let's talk about this."
Right. Yeah.
And so we start chatting, and I'm like, "You know what? I like what you're offering me. I love your product. I think it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go ahead and do this thing." So I just went ahead and just signed with him and called Kevin and said, "Look, you know, there's been too many barriers, basically, and it's not, you know, this is my 20th year in the business. I really want the book to come out this year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's important to have it out this year."
Mm-hmm.
And Kevin was really gracious and awesome and said, "Hey, if there's anything I can do to perpetuate things and get it, you know, where it needs to be, let me know."
Mm-hmm.
And then Joe, who's in Atlanta, I'm in Macon, like 2 hours south.
Right.
He was coming down to Macon to my studio,
mm.
like for 3-4 days at a clip.
Mm.
And we were actually designing the book in the studio, like, you know, shoulder to shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
the best way to do it.
Oh, it was awesome. It was awesome.
And it's like, what, 1,500 pages or something, Tony?
I think it's like a million. I think 311 pages, something like that.
Okay. Jeez. Okay. Yeah, that's...
It's huge. It's huge.
Yeah.
I think, I might be wrong, but I think it's the biggest book he's done yet.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't wait to get my hands on one of them because the PDF is awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kick ass.
I'm gonna quote Tony and say it's a thick ass book.
Yeah.
It's a thick ass book.
And you talked about a lot of stuff, man, you had to leave out. You know, it was kind of like, choosing, I think we made the analogy of choosing a child, you know, it was one to leave in and one to leave out. But, you know, everything couldn't make it into the final edit or the final galley, I guess.
Yeah, man.
No, we left a lot of stuff out. And by that, I mean, like, you know, there's Starman stuff in the book. There's JSA stuff in the book. There's Machina stuff in the book. But but we couldn't put, you know, everything I wanted to from each one of those projects in the book. Mm-hmm. Just because of page count, and most of my career was, you know, has been at DC, and they were the one company that did not give us permission to print. So we had to go by the fair usage.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Printing thing, which I'm not a lawyer, so I can't tell you what it is, but basically, if you say, okay, my page count is 300 or 300 whatever, only a certain percentage of that page count can be fair usage from that company.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If they don't give you permission. So we were limited to a certain page count for all my DC stuff, and what sucked is most of my career has been DC.
It's been DC, yeah.
I had to go through Starman and everything else and, like, say, okay, what are the choice pieces from all these DC projects?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we have to, like, get rid of everything else. We can't put, you know, that's hard, you know?
Yeah, but, to your credit, though, man, I'm just going to give a list real quick of everything that was inside the book as far as, like, some of the other stellar projects from different, you know, companies like G.I. Joe, Conan, Vampirella, Star Wars, Highlander, Angel, Indiana Jones, the Outdoor Life magazine you did. And let's not forget about the Bare Naked Ladies, which we all like.
Right.
Well, yeah. I mean, you guys have seen the PDF, so I mean, you tell me. I don't think I slighted my fans on Starman or there's still a good presence there in the book.
Yeah.
And what I said early on was, you know, we don't even need to bother doing this book if we can't have Starman in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean. You know, that put me on the map, so if we can't have Starman, let's not even do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we found out about that fair usage thing, and, you know, it was all good, so.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, man. And you have a forward in the book from James Robinson, your Starman collaborator, your ex-Gaijin studio mates, Adam, and Adam Hughes and Dave Johnson and Cully Hamner. Mm-hmm. Tim Bradstreet wrote one. Jim Royal wrote one, obviously, you know, before he passed. And
The one with Jim was amazing because we were actually going back and forth about his contribution, like, literally, like, a week before he died.
Mm.
So that's really special. But you know what? I actually reached out to everybody I've worked with over 20 years, and I mean writers, editors, colorists, inkers, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have testimonials from probably 50 guys, and not even a fraction of them got into the book.
Yeah, okay.
Because we started putting them in, and then we were like, okay, it's an art book. So do people want to read testimonials, or do they want to look at art?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And myself, as a huge fan of art books, like, you know, Struzan's book is, you know, my favorite of all time.
Yes, are you talking about Uber?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's a beautiful.
You know, there's not a lot of text in that book. It's just showcasing the art.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I had to really kind of whittle it down to, like, the testimonials that were the most personal and relevant to my career throughout the book. So I think maybe we have maybe 10, if that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think every one of them, like I said, is relevant to the work that you're looking at. So,
And they're all packed with personality too, you know, the specific authors. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah, I, Tony, I thought it was also cool too, man. That like you and I don't know where when you finished writing your Knock Knock Who's Fair, but you know you said some pretty honest things in your writing, and everybody else followed suit, man. Everybody you know didn't like kiss ass and say just glowing things about your art, which they could have done. You know, they had other things to say too. So it's a really well rounded look at not only the artwork to represent you, but also, you know, the impact and the feel that the people who collaborated with you over the years and your friends, you know.
Well, I told everybody that I contacted, I told them. My friend Seaborn was actually the first guy. I called him and said, hey, can you reach out to this list of people? Here's a list of names. It was like 150 names. Reach out to these guys and see if they want to be a part of the book. And I said, in your email to them, tell them that the gloves are off. I don't want a bunch of kiss-ass horse shit. You know, I don't. I want honest anecdotes about what it was like to work with me. And if I was a dick, then say I was a dick. You know, if I was like the most awesome son of a bitch you've ever worked with, then say that too. But you know, obviously I've got, you know, last say on the whole thing, but you know, I'm not above
criticism.
Admitting admitting that I was a jerk to this guy or that, because, you know, with a huge contingent of people, I do have a reputation for being a jackass, you know. But a lot of that is only because I'm passionate about you know, about what I'm doing, and if some of that comes across as rough or you know, or rude or whatever, then I apologize. But yeah, we definitely told everybody the gloves are off. Speak the truth, and unless you're just outright lying in your testimonial, I'm going to print it word for word.
Gotcha. I got you.
Awesome.
Hey, Tony, before we let you go, man, I can remember, man, when I first met you at a Heroes Con, I walked up to you to ask to take a picture. And so you struck a quick pose, and I took the picture, and then you just walked off. And I was like, okay, that guy's kind of a dick. You know? And then when Dwight met you at DragonCon.
Yeah, you were awesome.
Yeah, he was like, because I was gone, and he was like, Tony Harris just came by. He was here with Michael Golden, and he was cool. I was like, really? Yeah. And then he was like, yeah, man, he was awesome, man. He said he's going to come on the show with us. I was like, really?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't put comic book artists on the same level as Hollywood folks or anything like that, but we are public figures to some degree.
Yeah.
And it gets really tiresome.
Yeah.
On some level, when you've got, you know, especially if you do a ton of shows in 1 year, you know, you do, you know, 8 or 10 shows in one season, and you're getting pulled in 50 directions by 400,000 people. I mean, in one day, you know, just to put it into perspective for folks, at any given convention I do, in one day I can meet 200 people. And guess how many of those people I'm going to remember?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard. But you know what? I love doing shows. I love talking to people. I love having interaction with my fan base. Because, you know, our job as creators and comic book guys, it's a very solitary existence. I mean, you're in your studio on your own by yourself 7 days a week. You know, and the only time you get any kind of feedback on what you're doing is when you go to those shows. And I relish it. I love it. I love talking to people, even if it's negative. Oh, I hate what you did. But, you know, that's rare. You don't get too many people coming up and being honest with you and go, oh, that sucks. That's only on message boards. But I try to be as gracious as I can to everyone I talk to. within reason. And I'm human like everybody else, and I have bad days and I have good days. And yeah. And like you said, you probably caught me on a bad day.
Yeah.
And Swain caught me on a good one.
Well, Dwight caught you on a good day, and
Swain caught you on
a bad day. Oh, sorry. Yeah. I got it backwards. So, well, fuck you both.
See, no holds barred. Big thanks to Tony. He's absolutely worth the price of admission. Pick up Art and Skullduggery. You will thank us later. And again, this episode was brought to you by our buddies at Graham Crackers Comics. Shop with them online at grahamcrackers.com or stop by one of their stores and get your free Comic Book Wednesday on for the next 7 weeks. Booyah! And hey, if you like this podcast, please scream from the rooftops.
Go to sidebarnation.com.
From the main page, you can post a comment, send an email, jump in on our message board, make a donation to the nation, or peruse our back episodes located in the archives. You can also connect with Sidebar on Facebook, Twitter, and the Visual Artist Podcast Network as well. And if you wanna, you can pop on over to iTunes and leave us an iTunes music review. 5 stars would be like having my own pirate ship with Keira Knightley as a first mate. Arg, she'll be walking bow-legged in no time. Here's our announcer.
Well, that concludes another edition of Sidebar. I'm your announcer, Kay McFarland. Sidebar is a podcast on the subjects of comic books, art, and popular culture, created and co-hosted by Dwight Clark and Swain Hunt. Any questions, comments, or suggestions for the show, give us a shout at sidebarnation@gmail.com. That's sidebarnation@gmail.com. And you can also subscribe to the show for free at iTunes, Podcast Pickle, Digital Podcasts, and all the other podcatcher sites.
Tony, now who are you, before we let you go, man, who are your heroes? Who would you like to meet, and who would you like to turn into a fanboy if you got a chance to meet him or her?
Oh, Jesus. In comics, or
well, just whatever, any kind of art field, or you know, the visual arts. You
know? My God, you know, I would love. Okay, Christopher Walken.
Oh
yeah,
is my Jesus. My wife actually bought me a book about his entire career. It has an entire listing of all of his films. Anecdotes from him, personal quotes, and did you know that he actually had a cooking show?
No. You see, you take the dough.
It was called Cooking with Chris. and he didn't want to play ball with the network, so they fucking canceled it. How you doing? Not gonna do that. Suck it.
You want me to cook on the show with this uncomfortable hunk of metal up my ass?
Walken is my fucking hero. I love that guy. I keep a picture of him in my studio. And my brother actually lives in New York City and works on Broadway and in film and television. As a tailor and a dresser, and he actually got to meet Chris at dinner one night because he used to dress Sarah Jessica Parker on Sex and the City.
Okay.
And he had dinner with Chris and some other folks one night, and he got a for my Christmas present one year, got a photograph of Walken as the Headless Horseman.
Oh man!
The Hessian, actually. In Sleepy Hollow, and had him sign it. And he just took a big-ass blue Sharpie and just wrote, Chris, across the face. and so I asked my brother about it. I was like, so was he, my brother knows how much I love the guy. You know, I'm like, so was he cool? Was he cool? And he was like, well, you know, he's an alcoholic.
Okay.
So he kind of stunk like booze.
Wow.
I don't know how much truth there is to that or whatever, but anyway, I think the guy's, you know, an American legend. Mm-hmm. I think he owns his respect. He's my favorite guy in the world, and I would love to get 5 minutes with that dude.
Gonna need more cowbell.
Yeah, dude.